Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. As today, we start a series on the management of AML and MDS, and we're thrilled to be working today with Dr. Naval Daver from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And you can see we'll also be doing programs with Dr. Stone and Dr. Rabose as part of this series. And as always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As always, we have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey for you to take. If you could take that, we'll learn a little bit about you, and you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about metastatic colorectal cancer, particularly some of the new targeted approaches to HER2, BRAF, et cetera. Then on Thursday, we have a great program set up for localized non-small cell lung cancer, the use of immunotherapy as well as targeted therapy, of course, osimertinib, for example. And now it looks like there's a positive ALK study as well. On Tuesday, September 26th, we're going to be doing a really interesting program on relapsed mantle cell lymphoma and particularly how BTK inhibitors and CAR T fit in. On the 28th, we'll be starting a series on gastroesophageal cancers with Dr. Enziger. And then on the 3rd of October, we're going to do a program, we haven't done one recently, on non-melanoma skin cancer. A lot going on there, particularly in terms of checkpoint inhibitors. The first two Saturdays of October are going to be pretty special for us. We're doing 2-day-long programs. The first on October the 7th with a Florida cancer specialist. We'll be in Orlando with them if you're in that area. We have an all-day-long program with a bunch of great docs. And then the following week, we'll be out in Las Vegas. So with the American Oncology Network, another day-long program, another really great faculty. Between those two Saturdays, we're covering more than 20 tumors. You know, a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Daver's colleague, Dr. Garcia Manera, as well as Dr. Salmon. We'll talk about today some of the things they were talking about as well. But today we're here to talk with Dr. Daver about AML and MDS, so what's new. And as we always do in this series, we have a bunch of docs who are presenting cases, both general medical oncologists as well as a couple of people in the tertiary centers. So we'll see this real-world aspect of these diseases. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out talking about the biology and classification of these diseases and a little bit about P53 and magrolimab. Then we'll dive into some more of our case presentations, and if we have time, we'll get into the many papers that Dr. Daver has written. I was joking with Dr. Daver before we started that in the last couple of months, I've been noticing we do these two-year CVs on everybody, see what they published in the last year. And then I was sharing with the audience, we were doing a program with Georgina Long in melanoma a few weeks ago, and I'm like, wow, she had like 37 pages of stuff in the last 2 years. But Naval, you currently hold the record of 49 pages just in the last 2 years. It kind of remembers, I remember the first time I saw the CV of your colleague, Dr. Kantarjian, and it took me, like I'm scrolling through all the ASH papers. You know, I had that same. I just want to know how you do that. How do you get so much stuff done, Dr. Daver? Do you have an entire building of writers there?
Well, we have a lot of support. We're a big group, leukemia faculty, as you mentioned, Dr. Garcia Manero, Kantarjian. We're 40 leukemia faculty. So, you know, we all write papers and, you know, there's a lot of co-authors on them. But I think we all work very hard as well. So it's good.
It's really amazing how, you know, people in general are so productive nowadays also. It's really amazing. All right, let's dive in. Talk about taking care of patients. So we have a case I'm going to present to you. Of course, I want to hear what you have to say about magrolimab. Everybody's a little bit disappointed, you know, that things are kind of slowing down there, but I want to hear what's going on. First, you know, just to kind of, you know, get your global take on how you view the classification of AML and MDS. This is a typical type of diagram that a general medical oncologist is probably not going to want to dive into all the details. But can you kind of paint a picture of some of the broad issues involved in the biology of these diseases? You also had this other paper, and I love these artwork things. That's the only slides we usually show in webinars. We hope people will go back and check it out. And there you go into a lot of pathophysiology issues with MDS. So did you kind of summarize, kind of, you're making rounds with your fellows. How do you explain your vision for these diseases?
Yeah, I think first of all, I think the WHO versus ICC debate is a little bit overblown. I think that situation is unfortunate, and there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes. Myself, Amr Zaidan, many are involved to try and reconcile that, because I think it creates a lot of confusion in the community, which is negative for both the patients and the treating physicians and pathologists. But if you one really goes into the detail, which we did, and which is why we wrote these reviews, both of these classifications are moving towards a molecular and cytogenetic understanding of the disease. And I think that is the key message here, is that we don't think 5-10 years from now, and already these classifications have kind of fired the first shot, that we're going to talk about MDS 19% blast and AML 21% blast. This does not have clinical impact or change treatment. What we're going to talk about is, does the patient have an NPM1? Do they have a FLT3? Do they have a core binding factor? Do they have an MLL? So I think both these classifications are really saying, try to identify the underlying molecular or cytogenetic aberration. And if there's a targeted therapy or targetable aberration, then treat that. For example, let's say core binding factor inversion 16 or 821. It doesn't matter to me in clinic if I'm with the fellow or resident rounding and the blasts are 10% or 28% or 70%. I'm going to give that person induction chemotherapy with gemtuzumab, try to get a good deep molecular PCR remission, and then have a good chance of cure without transplant. And the same for TP53. If I see somebody with 7% or 40%, in general, it does not change the prognostic view or the treatment. So I think that's the message of both of these, without going into the nitty gritty, is that you look for the molecular, look for the cytogenetics, and use those, whether the blasts are below 10 or between 10 and 20 or above 20, and you're probably going to have the best outcome.
I don't know if we're going to get to all the papers we put. Out of those 49 pages, I only picked 27 articles to talk about. So I don't think we're going to get to all of them. But I saw a bunch of papers on checkpoint inhibitors, which is something I don't think about too much with AML and MDS. And here's a graphic from your MDS paper. Any future you see for checkpoint inhibitors in these diseases?
Yeah, I think there's still possibility, but it's probably not going to be the checkpoint inhibitors that people are used to in solid tumors. And we actually, personally, myself and Dr. Garcia-Manero, did a lot of the work with these checkpoint inhibitors, PD-1, PD-L1, CTLA-4. We looked at LAG-3, others, and in many different combinations. And we, unfortunately, were not able to find a suitable disease subset or population where there was really a great improvement in response. There's now a kind of a movement more towards the innate immune system, so macrophages and NK cells, dendritic cells, and we hope that some of those checkpoint pathways may be more relevant, at least the preclinical, very beautiful, elegant publications by many experts, Ravi Majeti, Irv Weizman, others, support that these may be more important in AML. So I think that group of drugs, whether it's the CD47 SIRP alpha checkpoints or NK cell based, may still be relevant. Now, the only checkpoint inhibitor among the more traditional that's still at play being developed in MDS and AML is the sabatolimab, which is the TIM-3 antibody. But even with that, we know at ASH last year, there was a randomized phase 2 data presented by Amr Zaidan, and that did not show an improvement in the overall survival or progression-free survival. So there is a phase 3 still that has not been read out, but we are a little bit anxious with that. So I think it's kind of going to be tough for checkpoint inhibitors in general in AML-MDS.
So let's start with the cases. You were bringing up TP53. This is a 73-year-old man with AML, and not only TP53, but also complex cytogenetics. Patient started out with CPX, progressed, azaven, progressed, now on palliative care. I'm sure you've heard that unfortunate story many times. I've seen it. Here's Dr. Halpern.
The discussion points in this case are largely the challenges of TP53 mutated disease. I think that we continually have been disappointed with therapies that in phase 1 and 2 studies look like they have good response rates for TP53 disease. A lot of people are interested in magrolimab. So just to the panel, upfront management of TP53 mutated disease, particularly with complex cytogenetics.
You mentioned magrolimab. Anything you'd like to put out to the faculty?
So I think that the hemolysis, particularly if the results bear out, particularly in TP53 disease, that this looks like this is going to be an efficacious drug, then I think the appetite for this is going to be large. But my concern is that it is going to be challenging for community oncologists to use. And that's not only with the initial hemolysis, which only really happens over the first week or two because it's the aged red blood cells that have the most CD47. The trouble is the magrolimab interferes with the type-in screen. And so it increases antibodies and you can't cross-match red blood cells. And so what we have done here is that you have to genotype the red blood cells before starting.
So I think it was a few days after Dr. Solomon and Dr. Garcia Manero said the phase 3 trial is going to be 100% positive. We saw this unfortunate press release, the discontinuation of the ENHANCE trial in MDS, and also a partial hold on the trial for AML. Before we get into your thoughts about sort of the biology of P53, what are your thoughts about what's going on? Do you think, you know, she mentioned the anemia thing. Maybe you can kind of go back over that. Do you think that maybe part of the problem was that maybe people weren't able to get the drug adequately because they were trying to deal with the anemia in the first few weeks? Do you think there's a future for this drug, either in AML or MDS?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a lot going on in the last just about a month or 6 weeks, right, with magrolimab. And as Dr. Solomon and Garcia Manero said, and I've been very closely involved, especially on the AML side leading those studies, we all were very optimistic. And of course, you have to realize it's treating physicians with a very, very difficult disease. Sometimes I think our optimal view or our optimism may help us, you know, believe things will hopefully work. And that is something we see in the phase 1B and 2 studies. And I think this brings up a number of issues. So I think number one, you know, all of these drugs, when we evaluate them in large academic centers with very good transfusion support, what Dr. Halperin was saying, ability to get RBC genotyping quickly. That's what we were doing. And so we would have the whole genotype within 48 hours. We were not worrying about the type and cross and the coding of the RBC with the magrolimab, which can affect the getting of the type and cross results. So a lot of these things may allow more efficient and more beneficial delivery of these drugs in big academic centers where you then start seeing good responses. But then, of course, the phase 3s have to expand to 140, 150 sites. Many of them are ex-US. And we have learned over time that a lot of times the resources, the ability to get same-day transfusions, RBC genotyping, admission of patients, especially those above 80, are much more restrictive and much more based on economics and what is considered economically the most viable in certain countries. And these things can affect the success or failure of trials. I still personally think that the pathway is important. I find it hard to believe that many Nature and Cancer Cell papers published from many groups on this, showing that this is a very important immune pathway, not just in AML, but also in lymphoma and potentially in solid tumors, are going to be wrong. So it could be one of two things. It could be the drug, maybe magrolimab, which is the first of now maybe 5 or 6 different CD47 antibodies, had more of an anemia issue, and that was too difficult to deliver in a community or smaller academic center. And the second, I think it could be just knowledge of the management of anemia, because as you said, we know that the discontinuation rates are much higher and much earlier than what we were expecting. And this actually led 1.5 years ago to a partial clinical hold on magrolimab. And then we came with urgent safety measures, and the MDS study had already been predominantly enrolled by that time. So it could be that the MDS study did not get the benefit of the enhanced urgent safety measures and monitoring, but hopefully the AML studies, which came a year, year and a half later, will still benefit from that. I think TP53 is probably the area where I still would be most interested in a drug like magrolimab, because nothing else works here. You know, TP53 mutation, it doesn't just affect the leukemia cell or the leukemic stem cell like we see with FLT3 or we see with NPM1. It tends to involve the tumor microenvironment, the immune biology, the ability to have normal differentiation. And so we often see that even if we clear the blast out, the entire microenvironment is so abrogated or impaired that we still don't get good count recovery. These patients still have a high tendency to get fungal bacterial infections. There's also a high predilection for cytokine release in HLH. So it's a really, really difficult disease. And what we've found over years is that if you go harder and harder and give more and more intensive chemo and venetoclax, actually, maybe sometimes it leads to more of a knee-jerk negative reaction in TP53, where you get more myelosuppression, more toxicity. And so we're now back to almost using HMA alone for many of our TP53. If I have a 75, 77-year-old TP53 mutated AML, and I'm not trying to go to transplant, in our group, many of us, including myself, are giving single agent HMA, because with HMA ven, you see a little bit of response improvement, but you get a lot of myelosuppression toxicity, and the survival was the same at about 6 to 7 months with HMA ven and HMA. Now, for a younger patient, like a 50, 60-year-old, where I want to go to transplant, I may still use HMA ven-based approach because you have about a 55% CR/CRI. You can move them to allotransplant. But the real answer is clinical trial. I think whatever trials we may have available, whether it's other CD47 antibodies, CD123 antibodies, other novel targeted agents, CDK9 inhibitors, MCL1, we're trying all of these because I think the TP53 is the one molecular subset where we cannot really claim any progress today. So we're still searching for something.
I just want to clarify, I don't think anybody really knows what's going on with these studies. We were just sort of speculating, you know, maybe there's going to be a toxicity issue. We don't know. It's going to be very, very interesting to see the data and find out what's going on. You mentioned all the papers you put out about TP53. Here's one, audience, in the slide deck, Cancer Discoveries. Really great artwork. Took a lot of great detail going through. I really recommend you check it out. Mechanism for magrolimab. I think people have seen this graphic. So let's move on now. We're going to try to pick up the pace here and see how many of these cases we can get through. So we're going to go to Dr. Battinger, who has a 59-year-old lady who's got multiple comorbidities, very obese, FLT3 ITD positive AML. Started out with Aza-Ven, now on gilteritinib. Here's the case.
This is a 59-year-old lady who has very morbid obesity, and cytogenetics revealed the presence of translocation 13-14, and she actually had a FLT3 ITD as well with an allelic ratio of 0.5. She had an NPM1 mutation. She was not considered to be an induction candidate given her numerous medical comorbidities. So she was treated initially with azacitidine and venetoclax.
So what happened after she progressed on azavenetoclax?
So she ended up getting just single agent gilteritinib because that was really all that she could tolerate. And oddly enough, she started it about 18 months ago and she's still in remission.
Wow.
So she's actually doing quite well.
Any tolerability issues with the gilteritinib at all?
No side effects whatsoever. She takes it religiously. Actually, she's never had a toxicity with that drug.
Any questions about crizartinib and the phase 3 QuANTUM study?
I am familiar with that study. I guess my question would be, in light of those results, where would the expert place quizartinib relative to gilteritinib as frontline therapy in patients who have a FLT3 ITD mutation?
So we'll get to the second question, but first, in terms of this case and how well this patient did on gilteritinib, any comments about it? And then the second question I'm going to ask you is, if this lady didn't have comorbidities at age 59, what kind of strategy would you have been thinking about, and where does crizartinib fit in? But let's just start out with the case as it is.
Yeah, no, this is great. So we're kind of going from TP53, where we have very little or no progress, really, to FLT3, where I think compared to 15 or 10 years ago, even now we have three drugs, FLT3 inhibitors approved, midostaurin, quizartinib in the frontline setting with intensive chemo, gilteritinib in salvage. So I think for this patient, you know, I think what has been seen by Dr. Bhatnagar is something we have all seen, and Dr. Sasha Pearl from the UPenn led the study of gilteritinib in relapsed refractory FLT3, the ADMIRAL phase 3 study, showing that gilteritinib had almost doubled the CRCRH responses with an improvement in survival compared to intensive chemo in relapse, establishing targeted therapy with gilteritinib in relapse AML. Now, that being said, the benefit this patient got is fantastic. We're very happy, but that is not usually the norm. What we've seen is the duration of response with single agent gilteritinib in relapse FLT3 has been between 6 to 10 months. The median survival in the ADMIRAL study was 9.3. It was better than the control arm, which was 5.4, but it was only about 10 months. And yes, there were about 20 to 25% who had long-term survival beyond 2 years, especially those who made a transplant. So we're not excited about just single-agent gilteritinib, and we actually did a study combining venetoclax with gilteritinib in the relapse FLT3, published that in the JCO last year, and saw that with this combination, we're almost doubling the response rates from 50 to 80%, but you do see more myelosuppression. So if I had such a patient today, my approach would probably be to the doublet of ven-gilt after failure of frontline therapy, and then we very quickly de-escalate the venetoclax down to 14 or even 10 days, continue the gilt. And with that, we're seeing more patients making a transplant as well as a better survival chance. Now, the second question, I think, is a really key question, because this is something now that's become a reality as early as just last month, because now we have two frontline FLT3 inhibitors. And as you show here, quizartinib just got approved 2 months ago. This was in the frontline setting based on a randomized phase 3 study of creep induction anthracycline cytarabine with quizartinib versus anthracycline cytarabine placebo. So the design of the study from a 10,000 foot view is very similar to the RATIFY study of midostaurin. But when you get into the details, there are two big differences. And the quizartinib study had a more difficult population. So one is it allowed patients above 60, close to half the population on this study. The quizartinib study was above 60, whereas the RATIFY midostaurin study, everybody was 18 to 60 years of age. So older population in the quizartinib study, usually a more difficult group. And the quizartinib study had all 100% FLT3 ITD, versus the RATIFY study where only 70% were FLT3 ITD, the other 30 were TKD mutation. And that's important because the FLT3 TKD tends to do better. So in general, a more difficult population in the quizartinib study, and we saw a similar outcome. But then when we went into the subset and tried to look at below 60 in the quizartinib versus below 60, which was the RATIFY population, we see the 4-year survival with quizartinib with chemo is 60% compared to a 4-year survival of midostaurin chemo of about 50%. And on top of that, my experience, we've used quizartinib probably the longest at MD Anderson, about 10 to 11 years. Dr. Cortez, who was here before, started the first phase 1 studies. And it's been a really, really well-tolerated drug. We see almost no GI side effects, very limited issues with liver, kidney. There is some QTC prolongation, but this is manageable with monitoring and avoiding cumulative QTC drugs. On the other hand, midostaurin, while a good drug, does have much more GI side effects, nausea, weird taste that a lot of patients have told me about, as well as a weird smell. So I think we at MD Anderson really have moved towards quizartinib in the frontline setting. Now, the third question, which Dr. Bhatnagar asked, we don't yet have data as to what about gilteritinib in the frontline setting. There is phase 1 data, single arm, and there's a randomized study that is near completion looking at gilteritinib versus midostaurin with intensive chemo. So we have to wait for that data, hopefully next year. And then we will have to decide if gilteritinib is positive and quizartinib is positive, then we have to look at molecular subsets, FLT3 allelic burden, co-mutations, and see which one we will use in a particular setting. But for today, until we have randomized gilteritinib data, I personally am using quizartinib upfront if patient is not going on a clinical trial.
Anything we want to say? Of course, this is published in The Lancet this year. The Quantum First study had survival benefit here with a hazard rate of 0.78, relapse-free survival, hazard rate of 0.61, and you can see the curves in terms of cumulative risk of relapse. Anything else you want to say about this trial or these data?
Yeah, I think one of the other things that's been discussed a lot in the FLT3 space is the maintenance. And I think one of the nice things with the Quantum First that's different from the RATIFY is that in the Quantum First, the label actually does allow maintenance in patients who are not going to transplant. So let's say you have a 60-year-old and you give him induction quizartinib and 3 or 4 consolidations, and you wanted to go to transplant, but because of finance or donor availability, logistics, patient could not make it. Now on label, we can continue the quizartinib maintenance for up to 3 years. And I think this is important because now there is a mass of data emerging showing that maintenance in the FLT3 setting, whether it's post-transplant maintenance or post-chemo maintenance, is improving survival. So I think that's nice that with quizartinib, if you cannot go to transplant, you use maintenance. Now, the other question is, what about post-stem cell transplant maintenance? And there is a study called the Morpho study that Mark Levis presented at the EHA that does suggest that this seems to have a clinical benefit in general, and especially for those who had molecular residual disease detectable by a high-sensitivity FLT3 PCR. So in MD Anderson, we are using maintenance after completion of induction consolidation, intensive chemo, whether it's post-transplant with gilteritinib or whether it's people who could not go to transplant, then we will continue what they got for induction consolidation, such as quizartinib.
So there are several papers related to the QuANTUM study just presented at EHA. This study by Schlenk et al. Looking at the impact of allogeneic transplant in these patients. Here's another study looking at quizartinib with intensive chemo. And then this study sounds interesting, AZA, low-dose sarasivan, and quizartinib. Any of these papers strike your fancy?
Yeah, so, you know, I think a couple of papers that were interesting is one, kind of you mentioned the one with Steve Napper, who's from the UK NCRI group. They're doing a lot of randomized studies. One of them was looking at adding quizartinib in wild-type patients, so not in FLT3 mutated, and what they used was a backbone of FLAG, intensive chemo with or without purine analog with gemtuzumab, and then they randomized to either receive quizartinib or not from second cycle onward. And in that study, they found that addition of quizartinib did not improve the event-free overall survival in FLT3 wild type. But then in that same session, there was another study by the Spanish group, by Palma and Tocinos, that looked at a kind of a simpler design where they did not have gemtuzumab or a purine analog. It was just anthracycline cytarabine 3+7 with quizartinib or just 3+7 with placebo in FLT3 wild type. And to me, that was probably the most surprising data from the EHA this June, where they actually showed quite a significant event-free and overall survival with quizartinib added to intensive chemo in the FLT3 wild-type population. So we don't know yet. This was one study, and I think there are other studies being planned. But specifically with quizartinib, we, even in the phase one, when Jorge Cortez was here at MD Anderson, published that there was activity in FLT3 wild-type relapse patients, up to 30% response. We did not see that with gilteritinib midostaurin. So there may be something unique with quizartinib. It could be a KIT inhibition or other factors where there could be a role for this in wild type population. So I think we will hear more about this in the next couple of years.
I need to get a little bell here that I'm going to ring every time I hear something really important that I never heard before, and I'd be ringing it right now. Why would quizartinib work in FLT3 wild type?
Yeah, you know, most of these drugs, we call them FLT3 inhibitors, but they really, some of them are not even designed as FLT3 inhibitors. So midostaurin, for example, you know, was actually designed for brain tumor glioblastoma in the late 90s. And then it didn't work. It didn't meet the endpoint of the primary registration studies. And then around early 2000, the FLT3 story came out and Novartis went back to the lab and said, oh, look, it inhibits FLT3. And so then we took it forward and said, okay, let's try it. Quizartinib, gilteritinib were designed a little bit more specifically, but still, when you look at the kinome, they target 8, 10, 15 other kinases, including KIT. And I think with quizartinib, the KIT inhibition could be very important. It's what causes myelosuppression more with quizartinib than, let's say, gilteritinib as a single agent, but it's also a pathway that is activated in most AMLs. So this KIT inhibition could be important in addition to the FLT3 inhibition and cause some wild type activity. We don't know yet, but clinically we're seeing activity with it.
Wow, super interesting. All right, well, let's go to another case. This patient has a FLT3 ITD also with AML, but also has IDH1. Here's Dr. Kerry Kakis.
7-year-old woman who came to the clinic for evaluation of pancytopenia. She has no symptoms except just weakness and loss of energy. The patient white cell count was 2.5 with a hemoglobin of 8 and platelets of 40,000. the pancytopenia warranted a bone marrow evaluation, which showed 45% myeloblast. The patient had complex cytogenetics, and she had IGH1 mutation and FLT3 mutation. Question is, how do you manage these patients with co-mutations at the same time? Which agent do you introduce first? For this patient, what guided me is the variant allelic frequency. And the question is, will the variant allelic frequency at next-gen sequencing guide the treatment for this patient? The patient had HMA with ivosidenib, and 6 months into treatment, the patient was in remission, but also they had QTc prolongation. I actually wanted to ask this question about how do you manage QTc prolongation in patients receiving ivosidenib?
And actually, the variant VAF for IDH1 was 43, and for FLT3 was 15%.
Yeah, I mean, this is not uncommon. Actually, today morning, I had an email from a colleague on very, very, very similar case, a patient with a co-occurring FLT3 and IDH. And what I will say is that in general, we focus on the FLT3. That's what both myself, Dr. DiNardo, was on the email. We both said exactly the same thing, that, you know, the FLT3 is often the key driver. And we actually published on this a few years ago, myself and her with one of our fellows, that when you look at the outcomes in co-mutated patients, the ones who got a FLT3 inhibitor early on seem to have a better response and a longer response. So even with a VAF that's lower, I think I may still have considered going for the FLT3 because it's a very powerful driver and it expands over time. Now, looks like it worked out here, and with the ivosidenib, there was response. The azivosidenib was evaluated in randomized phase 3 study, the AGILE study, and actually they did look at the impact of co-occurring kinase mutations, FLT3, RAS, others, and they actually did show that you can still see a good response. So I think this patient luckily had a response and was doing well. I have to say, we have not seen too much of an issue with QTc with ivosidenib. The label, I think, says about 3 to 5%. It's rare. So I think the first thing I would do is to see if there's any concurrent QTc prolonging drugs that we could potentially remove, you know, azoles, voriconazole, posaconazole, nausea medicines, Zofran, Phenergan maybe can be replaced with Compazine or other things. That would be the first thing. But in spite of that, if we're seeing, and when we talk about QTc prolongation, to me, it's not just the numeric prolongation that matters so much. You know, if somebody's QTc is 470, 475, and they're clinically doing well and their leukemia is in remission, probably wouldn't do anything. Now, if it's getting to above 500 or we're seeing any bradycardia or rhythm changes, then I think one would probably have to dose reduce the ivosidenib. And the last, if let's say you dose reduce, you've removed concomitant QTc prolonging medications and there's no benefit, then actually we're lucky because there's another IDH1 inhibitor that was just approved last year called olutasidenib. And that actually drug looks very, very good. In fact, the response rate and the duration of response are a little bit better than Ivo in the registration study. So then I would switch to the olutasidenib in that patient if the QTc is still bothering me and I cannot get it in a good range with these maneuvers.
Have IDH inhibitors been combined with FLT3 inhibitors?
You know, there was interest to do this. Ethan Stein and me and others were interested in it, but because of kind of different sponsors and companies, it never went forward. But the venetoclax actually works really well for IDH. And so in general, if we combine a ven, azaven with FLT3, so azaven gilteritinib, azaven quizartinib, that takes care of it. So for this patient, you know, really what we would have probably done at MD Anderson would have been HMA ven gilteritinib, and that would have really taken care of both clones and probably given a very, very deep remission. So that's still being optimized, but I think in the future, that may be the way to go for such mutations.
So let's go into another case, a 61-year-old man, a patient with MDS. And, you know, I'm really proud of adding these up, Naval. It's hard to believe. You know, we started doing these cases 3 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic. We presented more than 3,000 patients this way in a variety of tumor types. We presented, I think, over 90 cases like this of AML and MDS. And, you know, even though it's only a minute, I just feel, you know, it's so different than seeing a slide that says 61-year-old man when you hear it from the doc. And even in a minute, you kind of get much, to me, much more of a clinical feel. And I'm so appreciative of these docs, you know, being able to put their treatment right out in front for everybody to see. It's been an amazing experience. Here's Dr. Khan.
Yeah.
Very interesting, gentlemen. He presented with symptomatic pancytopenia, profound fatigue, daytime somnolence. Now, he is already disabled. He does not have much psychosocial support. He lives alone in a basement of a lady. His wife had died years ago from cancer. He has PTSD, anxiety. He is on multiple psychotropic medications, but he is functioning otherwise. He takes care of himself. He has this myelodysplastic syndrome, multi-lineage dysplasia. His ring sideroblasts were greater than 15%, and he also had aberrant monocytosis. This patient is not a candidate for allogeneic transplant. And this is my first patient where I use this oral hypomethylating agent, which is a combination of cedazuridine with decitabine. I think it is a fascinating combination. He received first cycle for 5 days, and he developed severe pancytopenia. Then I modified his regimen to 3 days. His hemoglobin has improved. His white count and platelets have both improved. Monocytosis has completely resolved. So one of the questions is whether in this type of situation, is this the best type of regimen for this particular patient?
Any thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, I completely agree with you. I love this kind of case-based discussion and, you know, kind of quick fire. It's also much easier on us. We don't have to prepare any slides and go through lots of data. And I think people like to listen to more open discussion. But, you know, the same way in AML MDS, there's been a lot of progress as well. And you know, one of those things that is just about 2 years ago during the pandemic, in fact, got approved was the oral decitabine is how we call it, but has a name, ASTX727 or Inqovi. And as Dr. Khan was saying, you know, the technology is really cool. The cedazuridine actually inhibits the GI degradation of decitabine, which is why we in the past could not give oral decitabine. Now the cedazuridine protects the decitabine from breaking down. And in a phase 2 alternating dosing schedule, in fact, led by Dr. Garcia Monero and Michael Savona, they showed that there was almost 99% PK equivalence with the oral decitabine to traditional IV decitabine. And that led to the FDA approval as an oral bioequivalent. So I think for this patient, you know, Dr. Khan clearly outlined all of the comorbidities, the psychological issues, physical issues, difficulty probably in coming in for infusions 5 to 7 days per month. And this is a great avenue of using an oral drug. But what he also said is also our experience that the oral decitabine, while logistically much easier, preferred by patients, does seem to have a more significant cytopenia. And the way it's approved currently is for 5 days. But for many patients, we're actually starting even with 4 or 3 days, especially in those who may be above 75, who may be frail, who may have severe cytopenias. And I'm worried on a practical basis, even though the label says 5 days, I may start with 3 days and then monitor closely for count recovery. But I do have a number of patients on this, and it's a great option. Once you get a response, you can continue these people, see them every 4 or 5 weeks, give them the 3 days. And they are having much time outside of the clinic and hospital.
And, you know, that's great for everybody, but particularly for this man, the way it was described, it's life-changing, really, to be have this option available really changes everything. So I think everybody has seen the data that really supports the use of this strategy. It came out, as you said, a couple years ago. What I want to ask you about is the idea of combining this with Ven, an all-oral regimen. I know you've looked at it in AML, and this is your paper from EHA looking at an MDS. So what's the bottom line here?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a logical next step. And you know, we are doing the first studies, the phase 1s here at Anderson in both MDS and AML. And this was the MDS study that was presented showing very encouraging response rates to the combination, very similar, actually a little better than what was previously shown with IVHMA-VEN in the multicenter phase 1B of IVHMA-VEN in MDS. So we think that there's a very, very good chance that this will be the eventual way we use it. Now, that being said, we still have to wait for the phase 3 randomized Verona study, which is a large study looking at AZA IV VEN versus AZA IV plus placebo in the higher risk MDS. But if that study is positive, I think very quickly, based on this data that we are generating, people will move to the oral with a 75-80% response rate. Survival, at least in the phase 1B, is looking very encouraging. This could be fantastic for MDS. And same way in AML, we presented at the ASH meeting, Dr. Avandi and colleagues, oral decitabine ASTX-VEN, showing that this was safe, deliverable, and seems to have good response rates. So I think oral, but even going beyond oral or doublet, we're also doing studies of the oral decitabine-VEN with targeted therapies, with IDH inhibitors, with gilteritinib inhibitors. So it may be, we're already doing it, and I think in the near future, if those studies pan out, then it's very possible you could get a 60, 65-year-old with FLT3. You give him 3 pills, oral decitabine, venetoclax, gilteritinib. Of course, you have to monitor, but this is something 15 years ago nobody would have imagined in the world of high-dose intensive chemotherapy and transplants. So really a lot is changing quickly in AML.
So in terms of course, the number one question you get from docs in practice about MDS is, when do we use HMA venetoclax? So right now, again, you're waiting for the phase 3 trial with the Verona study. But right now, can you describe a clinical situation where you'll attempt to use or will use HMA venetoclax with high-risk MDS?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that with VEN being available for AML and, you know, people not being too concerned, and I'm not too concerned about this blast of 18, 90, 20%, we are using it in patients who have greater than 5% blast, and especially if they don't have TP53, chromosome 17, or complex cytogenetics, because those patients don't generally tend to respond to VEN as well, whether they're MDS or AML. But for the others, 10%, 8%, 12% blast, we often are adding VEN, but we usually use much less VEN in MDS. 14 days is probably sufficient. Some cases we may even start with 12 or 10, because we do see some of these patients may have more prolonged myelosuppression than AML. But yeah, I would say for most patients with blast above 5, definitely above 10, without TP53, chromosome 17, complex cyto, we're leaning more towards HMA-VEN and then, if possible, allotransplant.
All right, let's see if we can pick up the pace here and go through a few more cases. Dr. Rachel Cook has a 66-year-old man, very interesting case, a patient with MDS. Here's the case.
An active guy, he was a pipe fitter. I noticed a little bit of shortness of breath, mild macrocytic anemia with a hemoglobin of 10.2, but an MCV of 111.2. His white count was borderline low at 4 with an ANC of 1.62. Platelets were normal at 316. And interestingly, his copper level was low. Subsequently, bone marrow biopsy that you can see ring sideroblasts. And those are classic findings, certainly for copper deficiency. But the interesting part was when his next generation sequencing came back, he also had an SF3B1 that was noted, also a common cause of ring sideroblasts. His karyotype was normal. His FISH didn't have any of the MDS abnormalities, and his molecular testing just had that SF3B1 and the DNMT3A. So it becomes an attribution issue. Do you feel comfortable saying this guy has MDS, and is the severity of his anemia concordant with what you're seeing in the marrow, or is there concern that he might actually have some copper deficiency that's contributing to it? You know, whether you want to treat the copper deficiency separate from the MDS.
Any thoughts about this one?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting case. We've seen kind of similar presentations, and definitely I would first do kind of a nutritional or vitamin replacement. So if we find copper, B12, folate, we look at those for most of our MDS patients, then we will start with that approach. And, you know, about 30 to 40% of the time, you will see that that actually gets all the counts better, and that's that. Now, if not, let's say you've replaced copper, checked all of the other B12 and folate and viral panels, and there's nothing else, then I think that this sounds like more likely it's an MDS with ring sideroblasts with SF3B1. Now, the good news is that this profile of MDS tends to have a very indolent, slow course, and these patients often can live very, very long. In fact, almost normal lifespan in most of these patients. They don't transform, they don't progress to high blast MDS AML. The bad news is that anemia is quite prominent and quite significant in most of these patients. So the drugs that have recently been evaluated and showed very good activity in this specific subset is a group of drugs called luspatercept and their ACE ligand traps. So they're different from the traditional erythropoietin stimulating agents that we use that stimulate erythropoietin. These actually work by preventing the breakdown degradation of erythropoietin, leading to a more prolonged effect and stimulation. And these were evaluated in two studies, the MEDALIST study initially and then the COMMAND study. Both of them showed very good responses, close to 60-70% responses for hemoglobin improvement in MDS patients, especially those with ring sideroblasts. And as you're showing here, these were the data presented and now published from this COMMAND study very recently, a few months ago. So that is probably what I would go for in this patient population. As you can see, close to around 65-70% response. And I think the durability was quite good, close to 1.5-2 years. So this would be good for this patient.
And this was actually approved in lower risk MDS recently and a few weeks ago. Next case, patient heavily pretreated for follicular lymphoma, got all kinds of chemotherapy, anthracyclines, etc. Now has AML. Here's Dr. Gupta.
A lady who's otherwise very healthy, excellent performance status, and heavily pretreated for follicular lymphoma. She has received everything under the sun, including anthracycline-based chemotherapy, bendamustine, venetoclax on a trial, and now she developed AML. So we really thought that this would be all treatment-related AML, but she really didn't have a whole lot of cytogenetic abnormalities or FISH abnormalities. So my question here was, she came recently, you know, she had new pancytopenia. So we did a bone marrow. She had acute myeloid leukemia. Just started her on CPX351 because she is technically eligible for transplant. And she wants to do that. In a patient who is above 65 years old, you know, how do we decide about intensive treatment versus non-intensive treatment? And then I really still don't have a good handle over when I should use that CPX351.
Yeah, this is a great question. Yeah. So, you know, I will say that our practice has heavily moved more towards ven-based treatments in patients above 65 and definitely above 70. This could be HMA-ven. It could be HMA-ven with a targeted therapy like a FLT3 IDH if they have that. And we probably would be inclined towards that approach. And even if I wanted to take them to transplant, I would still go with HMA-ven because you can get still close to 70% remission, even in secondary AML and move to transplant. Actually, to look at this, there were three retrospective studies that were presented, not at this ASH, but the last ASH, 2021, one from the Penn group, one from the Cornell group, one from the French. And all of them basically showed that what really mattered was getting the patient to transplant. So whether you used HMA-ven, whether you use CPX, if you didn't get a transplant, survival was equally poor, 8 to 10 months. But if you got to transplant, there was a 2 and 3 year survival of about 50%. So I don't necessarily know if CPX is necessarily the only way to get to transplant. Of course, there is randomized phase 3 data with CPX. And so people can use it. But I would say in our practice, we are moving more towards ven-based regimen, and we're still transplanting those patients. We actually just published, Nick Short in our group, a couple of months ago, analysis where we looked at patients who got to transplant, 60 to 75, and the path to transplant and whether it mattered. And in fact, with HMA-ven, cladribine rhodocyrosi-ven, intensive chemo, including CPX, the best outcome was those who got to transplant after cladribine rhodocyrosi-ven, then HMA-ven. So lower intensity approaches getting to transplant had better post-transplant survival, which makes sense because these patients are less beat up, less sick, less infection. So I think we're going to see a movement more towards ven-based lower intensity therapies in the 65 plus in the near future.
How about in the 65 down younger people?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, that's a great question. So I think 60 to 65, we talk about this a lot in our group. I still think we often move towards Venn-based, especially except if they have like an NPM1 or a core binding factor or FLT3, then of course those are very cytarabine sensitive. So that may switch the opinion. But below 60, I think is a big question. And there is actually a very nice randomized study by Amir Fathi with many other centers now in the US looking at HMA Venn versus traditional 3+7 or CPX in patients 18 to 60, 65 years of age. And of course, we expect 70, 80% of those patients to go to transplant. So I would not be surprised. In fact, my feeling is that that study is going to show HMA Venn is as good and may even turn out to be better than intensive chemo if you're taking the patient to transplant because patients are less beat up and sick. So it's not yet set. And below 60, I would say, except for the TP53 and really high risk, like in version 3, where chemo seems to not be beneficial, we're still doing intensive chemo. But this may change in the near future.
Interesting to think about getting an informed consent for a study randomized between HMA venetoclax and 7+3. But in any event, Hassan in the chat room says, do you transplant all AML FLT3 if donors are available? What about MPN1 mutated FLT3? Do you do it in first remission?
Yeah, the simple answer is yes. We transplant all of these patients. We are starting to look at NPM1 MRD. And if somebody with a FLT3 and NPM1 achieved MRD negativity, we may consider holding off. But I would still say about 90% of our FLT3 mutated, if able to go to transplant, we go to transplant.
So next case, this is from Dr. Olin, a 78-year-old woman with a newly diagnosed AML. Here's her questions.
78-year-old woman, history of slim sleep apnea, aortic sclerosis, also cutaneous lupus, and a history of pacemaker placement. She developed worsening cytopenias over time, although she was actually asymptomatic. She had a bone marrow biopsy, which showed 57% myeloid blasts, and she was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. This patient was also given decitabine plus venetoclax. We prescribed concurrent voriconazole, and the venetoclax was dose reduced to 100 milligrams for that reason. We performed a bone marrow biopsy at the end of cycle 1, which showed 10% cellularity with 1% blasts. And because she was significantly cytoreduced, we held the venetoclax for 2 weeks. But unfortunately, she did not have count recovery. We reduced the schedule of venetoclax to giving 4 days of decitabine instead of 5 days, and then also 14 days of venetoclax every 4 to 5 weeks. And this dose reduction did lead to an improvement in count, although she was still somewhat cytopenic. I'd love to hear panelists' opinions about whether they do or don't prescribe an antifungal with this regimen. I'm also wondering about people's practices about when to perform the first bone marrow biopsy. And then finally, I think there are many different approaches to what to do when patients are cytopenic on this regimen. How are we dose reducing? Are people reducing the dose or the schedule or both? And I think there's a lot of variety here, so I'd be curious to hear people's thoughts.
I was just thinking about these 80 cases we presented. Like, each one is different. There's like an AML and MDL. No two are the same. Anyhow, what do you think about this situation?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very common situation with AZA or decitabine Venn. You know, you get a remission. It's usually pretty quick. But then as you continue treatment, you start running into myelosuppression. I mean, to the specific questions that Dr. Olin was asking, number one, we do use antifungals with all of our patients who are getting HMA Venn. And this, I think, is geographically driven. You know, I know there are experts in certain regions, Dan Foley in Colorado, for example, where they don't use antifungals. And I don't think it's just that a difference in, you know, Dan versus us. I think it's the region, Colorado, very high city. We're in Houston, humid, you know, so I use it. I think each person has to look at their practice and what their fungal incidence is, and then use it. The second is we do a bone marrow for sure, end of cycle 1 for all patients. Usually it's around day 21, plus or minus a few days. And if we see on that day 21 marrow, cycle 1, day 21, that there's either remission, less than 5% blast, clearly documented, or a marrow aplasia or marrow wipeout, which is actually what we more commonly see, then we stop the Venn, and then we give 2-3 weeks for count recovery. And then for the subsequent cycle, we're really dropping the Venn down to about 14 days or less. So you really have to have a kind of a trigger finger to reduce VEN quickly as needed to allow for count recovery. But it is a good regimen when used that way.
So speaking of no two cases being the same, I love any case that starts out with 97-year-old. This is Dr. Eric. Here's Dr. Eric Ruppard.
This is a 97-year-old, wonderful lady with transfusion-dependent anemia. I did a bone marrow biopsy. Myelodysplastic syndrome was clearly present. And she also had a pretty significant plasmacytosis, maybe 15 to 20%. Unfortunately, began to develop a worsening anemia. And it was very symptomatic for her with hemoglobin in the 5 to 6 range. I started treating her with daratumumab, hoping I cleared her marrow of some of these plasma cells, although she felt better physically on the daratumumab, and she went into a biochemical remission of her myeloma quite quickly. She required transfusion about once or twice a month. In the last couple of months, sent off a FISH panel, and sure enough, she came back 5Q deleted or 5Q minus. So my plan is to discuss lenalidomide with her at the next visit. And my questions for the clinical investigators are, how did the very elderly, I mean, this is almost very, very elderly, 97-year-old, almost a centenarian, how do they tolerate lenalidomide? And do you start with a lower dose and titrate upward, or do you start at 25 milligrams and titrate downward? How often do you see these myeloma and MDS overlap patients? If you see MDS and myeloma, you know, which is causing the hemoglobin to be low?
Yeah.
I've heard a few cases like this.
Yeah, really?
I've heard a number of cases like that, yeah.
Well, I guess it's good people are living older, right? You know? But
no, I mean the combination of myeloma and MDS.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. We definitely see that. And actually, the deletion 5Q is one that's commonly seen. And very commonly, they have a TP53 mutation along with it. So I think the first thing for this patient would be, it may not matter at 97, but there's probably a small TP53 clone. However, there was a study, the CINTRA-REV study, where they randomized Revlimid versus observation, and they showed that the hemoglobin improvement was quite dramatic with Revlimid-based therapies, and people became transfusion independent, did very, very well. So I would do Revlimid. Now, at 97, I personally don't actually have a 97-year-old who I've ever given Revlimid. I don't remember in our group, but I would probably be cautious and start with 5 instead of 10 milligrams, 5 milligrams daily, see how she does. You may even have to go down to 5 milligrams 3 times a week or so, because you don't want too much neutropenia, thrombocytopenia at the improvement of the anemia. But I think, you know, if we can get her a couple of years with that, staying on a low-dose Revlimid schedule, I think that would be the goal here.
So $5 fine for saying Revlimid, you know, sorry.
Ah, that's just true. Kidding. That's right. Lenalidomide,
just kidding. Yes. Anyhow, last thing I want to ask you about is, I looked at my schedule a couple of weeks ago, and there I see a 90-minute session I'm supposed to be doing on blastic plasmacytoid dendritic cell neoplasm with your colleague, Dr. Pemaraju. And wow, we needed all 90 minutes to talk about it. But what I want to ask you about, and I know you're very involved with this research too, is you wrote this other paper on antibody drug conjugates in AML. And you know, other than GO, I'm not hearing about too much, but he was telling me about this CD123 ADC, pivkimimab. Yeah. And curious whether you think this, you know, obviously BP at DCN is not very common, but any thoughts about whether this might have a shot in AML?
Well, first of all, I think 90 minutes is always short with my friend Naveen Pemaraju. As you know, Naveen has a lot to say, right? So he will go.
For sure.
But yeah, you know, we both are actually co-leading this effort with this bivacumab. There's a CD123 antibody already approved, Tagraxofusp, SL401 is the name, in BPDCN that Naveen actually led that study. But now with the Immunogen, we actually find this to be a safer, less capillary leak, less systemic edema, once every 21 days infusion. We don't have to monitor albumin or weight. So this drug is moving forward. It's an ADC, antibody drug conjugate, with the conjugate being toxin called IGN, which is basically a DNA alkylating single-strand break-inducing drug. So BPDCN is kind of the first shot. We think that's a very good chance. Hopefully this will be approved and become the drug of choice in BPDCN based on the safety efficacy data. But then it's also being evaluated in AML, which is kind of the part that I'm leading those efforts in frontline studies in combination with AzaVen. And the nice thing with this drug was that it actually had single agent activity in relapsed refractory AML, about 25%, which is not something we saw with the SL401 or with magrolimab or other antibodies. So that's why we think we're seeing better frontline activity, and it hopefully will lead to registration approaches in the near future for AML. But I think the CD123 and antibody drug conjugates in general are coming back quite quickly in AML. So you'll hear about those in the next few years.
So I just saw Case pop into the chat room. Some of these things in the chat room were over my head. I was afraid to even ask you about because I didn't understand them. But this one is interesting from Uzoma, 68-year-old with high-risk AML, multiple cytogenetic abnormalities, achieves a CR with cycle one of Ven-Aza, remains in CR for 12 months on Ven-Aza, transfusion independent. How long would you continue the Ven-Aza? Would you stop the Aza, continue the Ven alone? If the cytopenias remain resolved, is there a reason to continue antibiotics and antifungals?
Yeah, I think I would continue AzaVen. You know, we have been very nervous to stop AzaVen. We attenuate the schedule. So I have patients who are like on 3 days or 4 days of Aza and 7 days of Ven, getting every 6 weeks. But we haven't stopped. You know, there was a study that looked at stopping AzaVen, Dan Polier did one. And in our group, Courtney, me, and others, we looked at it. And we do see relapses occurring. So even in patients in a year, 18 months in remission. So I think for now, our stance is continue it, attenuate it, but do the treatment 3 to 5 days is fine of Aza and Ven. The antifungals and antibiotics, if the patient is truly maintaining ANC stable above 0.51, not dropping in the middle of the cycles too much, then I think it's totally fine to stop those. Yep.
All right. Well, Naval, thank you so much for working with us today. I know we all learned so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back tomorrow night, I'm really looking forward to hear about HER2-positive metastatic CRC, MSI, BRAF, et cetera, lot to talk about there. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Naval.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye.